Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Social Work Mentor Podcast. This is a series that I've begun that we call Social Work Stories. And in this episode, I'll be interviewing Enrique Alvarez, who's a licensed clinical social worker and a psychiatric social worker in the San Francisco Bay Area. In this episode, he covers a number of topics, including the challenges with bureaucracies, as well as how to take care of yourself during a pandemic. If you want to listen to more content like this, as we keep going throughout this series, interviewing interesting and informative social workers in the field, follow us on social media at Social Work Mentor or subscribe to this podcast so you get notified when we come out with our next episode. So for now, here's the episode. I hope you enjoy it. Hey, everybody, welcome. This is a conversation that we're having today about social work in general and a little bit more specific topics about some current themes in social work. I have a guest today, but before we get to my guest, I'll introduce myself. My name is Ernesto Bejarano. I am the founder of Social Work Mentor. And you can go to socialworkmentor.com and find that, and I'll provide some links in the description of this video at some point. But these are interviews that I do. I occasionally do interviews with social workers, colleagues that are doing different things in the field, primarily with the purpose of just getting to know them and getting to find out a little bit about who they are, what their journey has been, and their thoughts on social work. And this is primarily intended for maybe social workers who are new in the field or people who are thinking about getting into social work, just to give you an idea of what social work is all about and some of the realities that you might see out there. You obviously get the education that you get in school, trainings that you may go to, but this is meant to be a little more real life and kind of down in the trenches. So with that being said, I'm going to introduce our guest today. This is Mr. Enrique Alvarez, and let me just make sure I have his, there we go.
Okay.
Mr. Enrique Alvarez, I've known this guy for many years now. We've gone through some good times and some tough times. And now we've kind of gone on a little bit different paths, but we're still both very involved in social work. First, thank you, Enrique, for being here and welcome. And so I'm going to go ahead and get started by just allowing you. Why don't you go ahead and tell us, because you kind of have a, at least here in California, you have a little bit of an interesting background. It's not, you know, most social workers that we work with are from around here, this area, but you've taken a different path to get here. So why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and how you got here and anything you want to share about your own personal life or experiences to this point?
Oh, thank you, Ernesto. I think this is a great opportunity to meet other colleagues in the field and also provide a little bit of a history of how people come about to social work. Well, I'm Cuban. I was born in Cuba, and I grew up in Puerto Rico. I really learned English when I was 18 years old. Many of you could relate to ESL, English as a Second Language classes, and that was significant, you know, that process early on. So I grew up in Puerto Rico, then lived in Long Beach in the 80s, and then Miami, and then I've been in San Jose since 1997. So a long time now. But you know, I think I wasn't into social work until later on in my life. But I think I've always been a community activist and connected to the community. But my bachelor's, I have a bachelor's in criminal justice. I think at that time it was Florida International University.
Oh, I didn't even know.
FIU, a small university, and now it's bigger. So criminal justice, and then from there, I was a federal correctional officer. So I was in the federal system for like 12 years. And then in 2000, I quit after 12 years of in the field and went to San Jose State for a master. And I think that
was there anything that made you like, was there anything that were you not enjoying the job or were you just looking for a change or what made you quit and go into your master's program?
It's a good question because we in social work, we talk about having a good fit, you know, like when in child welfare, we look at the child and the family and having a good fit is important. Criminal justice and law enforcement wasn't a good fit for me. I wasn't the best federal correctional officer. I mean, I was good, but I wasn't into enforcing minors. I was in a federal penitentiaries for like 12 years. I just got tired. I thought there was something more to do. And I always wanted to work with families and communities. So, and I researched and social work, and that was 2000, 20 years ago. And social work was the most marketable career that, you know, and broad that you could go into. I mean, I think that was just tired of the system. And it was kind of dead end. Go ahead.
Was it that your criminal justice academic background had kind of prepared you for the enforcement side of criminal justice? But is it accurate to say that wasn't meeting your real needs for, you know, more of advocacy, empowerment, that type of thing?
Correct. Yeah. And it was like a sense of a dead end, like you're in a dead end and you're not enjoying what you're doing. The impact that you're having. Yeah, you're a correctional officer and you're enforcing laws and making sure that people are safe inside the institutions. But that was it. You know, there was not much to it. And I wasn't a law enforcement type. I've never been a law enforcement type. I think I have always been a social worker. And I think that drove my family and my experience as an immigrant has always been kind of social work oriented. I've always been involved in communities. And so I think that was a big step because, I mean, I had I had 12 years in the system and I was going to change. I had been out of school for like almost 12 years. So I was in my 30s, 35 or something. I was going to go back to a master program.
Yeah. And I think there's a big lesson in that for people that are listening. And like I said, maybe younger people just starting in their career is that, you know, this type of work that's very broad in scope, it could go everywhere from, you know, administration of justice or criminal justice all the way through to nonprofit, you know, work with homeless shelters and things like that. It's so wide. And so one thing that, you know, this may not be the case for everyone, but it's always important to remember that there are opportunities out there, many opportunities for you to continue to do work that kind of is a better fit, as you mentioned. And so if, you know, Enrique, it sounds like I don't know if you felt like you waited too long or if it was just the right time, but regardless.
Go ahead.
Just to finish that thought, you realized that it wasn't a good fit and you moved on because I think you and I have both known people that kind of stayed in a position and it wasn't right for them. It wasn't the right fit. And that maybe affected the work they did and the quality of services they provided because they just, you know, they stayed somewhere where it wasn't maybe a fit for them. And so to hear you, just this first part of your journey, recognize that it wasn't a fit. I need to find where my passion is, where my desires are, where I could be the most impactful. You know, that's a good lesson for people to hear, I think, especially early in their careers.
Yeah, and I think that another part, a very significant part of that experience after my bachelor's, it's like the amount of volunteer work that I always became involved in. So it was very interesting because I had a career in criminal justice and in corrections, but in my life, in my secret life outside the not my secret life, but my life, my other side of my life, I was volunteering. I had a lot of experience. I mean, I was in Miami. They call it guardian ad litem, which is a child's advocate. I did that for a long time. I volunteer in foster home, I mean, in group homes. I also, in those years, became a helpline. There was a, I used to be in Long Park, which is close to Santa Barbara. And there's a big organization called Helpline over there. And it's kind of a suicide hotline. And I remember being working as a correctional officer, being a law enforcement type. And then in the evenings or on my other shifts, I was providing mental health counseling services to students at Santa Barbara, people that used to call into the hotline. So,
wow, that's pretty amazing that you were able to do that flip, that switch from one kind of extreme to another.
And I think it wasn't, that's the interesting part, that it wasn't really a switch. I think that I forced myself to be a correctional officer. Like I always was a social worker internally, but you know, I chose that, made those decisions about becoming a correctional officer. But I was a correctional officer, outwardly dressed up like a correctional officer. But inside, I was a social worker. It was very interesting. It was a very struggle because I didn't feel comfortable.
Did you have at that time any kind of like a mentor or someone that you confided in or that you could talk through some of this?
I think that my family, my sisters, I have two older sisters, and I think their own path in how also influenced me. I think being an immigrant is a really significant thing. I think being not having a lot of resources, having to learn your second language at 18 years old, all those things came into play. But I think that, and then while I was in social, in criminal, while I was in corrections, I attended the University of Miami. And I got a certificate in drugs and alcohol counseling.
Was it party time at Miami? I know that every time I see Miami is I wish I was there having a good time.
It was a challenging time in Miami. We're talking 1980s in Miami. Wow. Mariel Botlev, cocaine cowboys, and all that thing that happened in Miami in the '80s. But I really felt like I needed to get out of law enforcement and become more of a, practice. So I took this certificate. It was a certificate program. It was like a lot of hours. And it was University of Miami. So I used to work my regular shift and then go and study. And I actually did an internship. It's amazing.
In Miami.
I did an internship in a rehab center. And it was a great experience. I ran 12-step groups, and it was a great experience. But at the same time, that experience ended, and then I needed to go back to my regular law enforcement duties in the institution.
So at this point, In your story, about how old were you at this, or how many years into your kind of professional journey were you at this so far at this point of the story?
Well, I think when I quit, I was 35. So I was a late bloomer. So I finished my bachelor's when I was like 25. And I think that's
You were kind of seasoned. You had some seasoning, in criminal justice, and you were not what we would maybe call fresh or green social worker. You knew through all your experiences, you kind of had a good idea of the type of jobs, the type of work, the type of needs that were out there.
Yeah. And I think that, I thought, well, that was it. I was 25 years old and I had a federal job and I got into the federal system and, I think that gave me the opportunity to really understand human behavior. I think that's why I'm so good at working with populations that other social workers have a hard time. So, for example, incarcerated males, I would say, like, you know, the tough guys, you know, I mean, some people get, not that I'm an expert on it, I guess I have more experience on working with that population.
You can say that you're an expert.
I think that human behavior is, you know, as a correctional officer, a big part of what you do is not force, but it's like you study human behavior and how you interact with people. I mean, I always say that I in 12 years I was in the system with, I never had any assault. I was never assaulted or anything ever happened to me because I wasn't the type of correctional officer that gave you a hard time.
Hey, everyone, this is Ernesto. I hope you're enjoying the interview so far and hearing about Enrique's career journey and how he got to where he is today. I did recently put together a list of the top 10 skills that you need to be a successful social worker. So if you are early in your social work career and you're wondering if you have what it takes to get some longevity out of this, you'll want to check out that list. Or maybe you're even earlier than that and you're just considering jumping into the field, but you want to know if you have what it takes to be successful. Well, for sure, this list will provide you with ideas and some knowledge about what it takes to be a successful social worker. Or even if you are a seasoned social worker with a lot of years of experience, this list would be something you could share with up-and-coming social workers to make sure that they're on the same page with all of us about just what it takes to do the right things and be successful in the field. So the link for that is bit.ly/SWN10skills, but I'll leave a link down in the description of this episode. So enough of that for now. Let's hear a little bit more from Enrique as the interview continues.
I might even have let things go. You know, I think I let some people, homemade wine, hooch. That's what they call it. I find homemade wine on a regular basis. And sometimes I identify people that were drunk and perhaps, you know, didn't enforce it as I needed to if I wasn't in the law enforcement. But
mentality. And I think I'm hoping later in this conversation, we're going to get into a little bit of that because I know we talked prior to this interview about, you know, some of the subtle nuances in social work that you're not going to find in the books, you're not going to find in the CEU training necessarily, but there are things that we do as social workers during the rapport building process or just ongoing in our relationship with those that we work with that are kind of more things that we do or don't do that allow us to better work with those clients. Now, obviously, there's ethical considerations and there's laws that we need to follow and those types of things. Yes. But we're going to get a little bit into that. But just real quick before you continue, another thing I wanted to point out to any newer social workers or people thinking about getting into social work is, Enrique, you mentioned one thing that really kind of helped you to see other opportunities was through volunteering and doing all the things you mentioned. And I think it's very significant for people that are interested in this field or starting in the field, because it really does open your eyes at the ground level to the type of work, the type of individuals that you'll work with. So I just want to kind of put a little shout out for volunteering for those that are kind of, it's the best way to explore, you know, volunteering or internships, kind of to explore the opportunities and explore yourself to see, you know, if you have what it takes to do this kind of work.
Yeah, exactly. I think being a volunteer is a great opportunity. Plus you're also serving the community. And I think that a lot of people that want to get into social work, I really encourage them to volunteer in anything that you like, you know? But I think that one of the things that is really important to point out is that, and now I have a greater understanding of what does it means, but a relational approach. Social work is not about the knowledge that you have about theories or you know, about how to do certain things is how well you're able to relate to people. That is the core of social work. I mean, we are taught like meet the client where he's at, but we're not taught how to do that. You know, I mean, I think we understand the concept of meet your client where they're at.
Great point.
But it's a relational approach. And that is the core of all social work practice. It doesn't really matter where you're at. You could be a reunification child welfare social worker. You could be a mental health therapist. You could be, but social work requires that you develop relationships. Even as a policymaker, social worker, you have to develop relationships with other people. Mm-hmm. And collaborate with other people. So that's really, really, really important.
And I think you and I both have had the experience of working in large bureaucracies. And unfortunately, at least in my opinion, sometimes the bureaucratic nature of that work really does, it can kind of suck that out of you, the human side of it, because you're worried about the timelines on that next report, or, you know, getting in your case notes, you know, by this day or this time, or like whatever the you know, the compliance things are, and that it becomes a barrier at some point to that relational work that you're talking about.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I'm able to tell you professionally in 2002, I completed my master's in social work. Over 18 years ago. And, you know, and I was a Title IV-E child welfare recipient. So I had to work in child welfare. So I work in the Department of Family
and Social. Can you just real briefly explain what that program is for those who may not be familiar with it?
Title IV-E is a federal program. That Title IV-E comes from the Social Security Act. I don't know where the funding comes from exactly, but it allows you to attend school. You commit yourself. They give you a certain amount per month. I think at that time, for 2 years, it was like $18,500 that you'd receive. Uh-huh. And then your commitment is to work in child welfare after that. For at least two years.
Right.
So it was very interesting because when I quit, I knew I wanted to go to graduate school, and I was going to do it regardless of how many ramen and noodles I was going to eat, but I was going to be poor. But what happened is that I got Title IV-E and it kind of worked out. And interestingly enough, because I had done some groups before, while I was in graduate school, I began doing domestic violence groups, 52 weeks batterers groups. And it's interesting
because I used to do in grad school.
While I was in grad school for a local agency here in San Jose in the Bay Area, and I was doing like three or four groups a week. And I was doing a population which I could relate to, which is a Spanish-speaking males. And that's a population that gets misunderstood. And a lot of people have a hard time working with batterers. But once again, I was here working with a population that I was working with. I was in corrections. These are people that have been acted violently towards their partners or their children. And the goal was to connect with them and kind of provide a different perspective. And I know there's a lot, we're not going to get into it, but there's a lot of controversy about how successful those groups are or not. But I believe they're successful, and I believe there's a lot of good that could come out of that. But anyway, that was my graduate school participation. So I became, just to finish my experience, I became a child welfare social worker. And I worked for DFCS in Santa Clara County, Department of Family and Children's Services, for almost 12 years. And in those 12 years, I was in the Spanish-speaking unit, domestic violence unit. I was into a sexual assault unit, and I did a little bit of emergency response. And I loved child welfare. But once again, I felt the need to move on. After almost 12 years, I went to work with the Department of Alcohol and Drugs, and then I went into juvenile hall. And I was in juvenile hall for like 18 months in juvenile hall. I was in working with in a specific court, treatment court, substance abuse treatment court for juveniles. And then in that process, I was gathering my hours. And in 2013, I passed both of my tests and became a licensed social worker, LCSW. Which that in itself was an experience, because I never thought that I was going to become an LCSW, and I never thought I was going to be in mental health. I always thought I was going to be in child welfare. And then things kind of happened and developed, and I went to do drugs and alcohol. Those times that experience that I have in drug and alcohol treatment, it kind of came to play years later. And that's amazing. That's something that we could talk about it. How the volunteer work, the certificates of almost 15 years ago, maybe longer, came to play for that job.
And yeah, then it's interesting how, you know, people that have been in it for a while, and I'm sure there's some of them that will see this at some point, but it's just interesting how the experiences in our career just kind of find their way of weaving themselves into each other. And you might have done something 20 years ago that you thought was gone and dusty, but you get into a position or a role, you dust that off, and you can still apply that experience and add to it in a new role. And so it's you know, I'm sure this happens in other professions, but it really stands out in social work, how the things that we've gone through, the experiences that we've had, how they can at any point in time kind of be of use to you in the service of new clients or families that you're working with.
Yeah, that's correct. A lot of transferable skills that you transfer. And then over 5 years ago, I went into mental health. And that's currently what I work. I work for a county mental health, the Department of Behavioral Health. I'm a psychiatric social worker. And I love that job. It's interesting because after 18 years in the county as a social worker, a lot of my colleagues have moved on to supervisory positions and management and other positions. And I, you know, I, not that I struggle with it, but I decided a long time ago that I love direct service. And that, and I'm really good at it. Just to be, you know, be humble.
No, I can vouch for that. And you're really good at it, as you mentioned, with this, I mean, with anyone, but really these specific populations that you're talking about, like, it's hard for those populations to find the right person that can have build that relational, you know, work style or whatever, and you are one of the individuals I can vouch for that at least in this local area, when they work with you, they know that they're getting a service that they deserve, the services that meet their needs. And so I for sure know that you're an expert and you're good at social work in general, but with these specific populations specifically.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think that I have devoted my past 18 years with work with Latino families, Spanish-speaking families. Yeah, every once in a while I get an English-speaking case, but my concentration has been with Latino families. And be honest with you, even after all these years, I still get – it's not that I benefit them, but they benefit me. I learned so much about the resiliency from these families. I learned so much about hard work that these families do to provide. I'm the advocate. I'm a strong advocate for education, for families to meet their needs. So yeah, I mean, I think it's exciting to know that an old man like I am, after 18 years of social work practice, I'm still have the fire. I had the same fire that I have 18 years ago, and it is because awesome. Not because of I'm. Once again, I'm as you guys, as you know, Ernesto, I'm not a system person. I am a union. I'm a union troublemaker. And so I have it's really interesting because I work in systems and I struggle with these systems and how these systems sometimes don't meet the needs of the family. So
and the best ways to challenge that system to meet those needs, which we'll get into in a minute.
Yeah, but I think that you know I think that I right now a lot they're higher. I have a few cases where we have some. I'm advocating strongly for families and children to educational needs. So my population that I work right now is I work for 6 to 18 children and families. Predominantly Spanish-speaking families. And so as a therapist, I'm able to provide a lot of different services. I'm not only a mental health therapist. I think that always that LCSW, it's a state license. It's a licensed clinical social worker. But the bottom line is that I'm a social worker. And that means that I have to develop these relationships. Virtual relationships with families.
It's a lot different in the past.
Yeah, 10 exactly. I work with kids with a lot of developmental needs, and I have to become very creative and animated during my sessions, you know? I wouldn't do anything else right now. I mean, I think that I don't know what the future might bring. And I don't know, I will have a hard time working with adults. Not that I haven't worked with adults in mental health, but right now, I think that I'm enjoying even the last 7 months. How difficult it has been to must have been. Remember the relational approach to practice that. I think I'm finding ways to do it, and I'm always trying to be creative in the ways that I do it. So
yeah. Well, thanks. First of all, I want to say that as I mentioned, I've known Enrique for a while now, and you know, this move towards technology and the creativity with technology. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a bit of a jump for you. Like, you weren't necessarily Mr. Although we're in the Silicon Valley area, you know, Enrique wasn't necessarily a programmer or an engineer. No. but the things he tells me about that he's doing to be innovative in that pursuit of serving these youth that he works with and these families is it just goes to show another lesson is that you know, you always need to be able to adapt. And you can't go through this career and saying, oh, I can't do that. That's not my style. I don't know how to do that. You always have to be open to the possibility that you may need to adapt even to your biggest weakness sometimes, because it's not when you're on the job, at least it's not about you. It's about what you need to do or how you need to change to serve the clients that you're working with. So that's one thing that I just wanted to give you props for, because I know that tech maybe isn't always your thing, but I hear you, what you're doing, and you've stepped up to the plate with that. And then the question that I wanted to ask, you mentioned sometimes you get an English-speaking case, and I know you work primarily with either a Latino or a Spanish-speaking population. And so can you speak a little bit within that context of relationships and relational type work? Can you talk about, and obviously every family is an individual family or person, but just the difference between maybe a Latino or an immigrant or a Spanish-speaking family, and how you know, what it looks like to build the relationships there, the challenges that they may have, the things that they may need, versus maybe an English-speaking case or a family that's been here several generations at least. Are there differences you notice there?
I think that the main difference as a social worker is gathering information. So to know what experiences the family that you're working with has had, how did they came about to, how come are we here now? And why are there, what are their expectations about the services that are available? And I think language is a big part. I mean, I'm not against families being served by an English speaking person, Spanish speaking right. family, but I do mm-hmm. think that the use of language and the use of cultural plays a big part of it. Mm-hmm. I think that the big difference is that how the Latino families develop the type of relationship that they develop with you. I think a lot of times I had to correct them. They call me Dr. Alvarez, and I say, I'm not a doctor, or they think I'm a psychologist, but I'm not a psychologist. So the sense of, you know, they feel some kind of, not that other families don't, but I think mm-hmm. that's the part that you develop different relationship. And I think it's understanding also where they're at. I mean, typically English-speaking families don't have the immigration issues that a Latino family might be experiencing. Typically, there's a different connection and socioeconomics. I mean, they might be mm-hmm. all in medical recipients, but there's the different socioeconomics. There's a difference in education, levels of education. I think a lot of, and once again, this is not across the board, but some right. of the differences. I think that some of the families that have a minimal amount of, the parents that have minimal education, some of them have other college in Mexico or someplace else, Latin America. But most of them, they have minimal amount of education, and that impacts how you provide services. And that means mm-hmm. that you have to spend more time educating the family about different systems, mm-hmm. how different systems work. For example, because a lot of the, for example, if you go to a website right now of a school district, let's say your kid is in a school district, and you want to find out about services that that school district provides. If you're English speaking, you're more than likely, you could go into the website and read and become informed. If you're Spanish speaking, that website would not provide you, most websites do not provide you that information in Spanish. So mm-hmm. that's a big difference. How do people access services?
I love that you said, you know, that you brought up that point that we, you know, we work with families who are engaging in systems, whether that's the school system, the hospital system, the child welfare system, whatever it is. And some families, just by nature of either they've been here, they're not immigrant families, or they have a grasp of the language, or they have an educational background, they're able to navigate those systems, at least at the very least, at a rudimentary kind of level. But a lot of the families that we work with sometimes either, you know, got here 6 months ago, they immigrated here, or they don't speak the language, or they've never interacted with child welfare, and now there's people knocking at their door. And so just the time that it takes, as you mentioned, to familiarize, first of all, to make those people just feel comfortable working with you, because you're also, in many of these instances, you're part of those systems that they don't understand. And yeah. so to have them trust you, to have them work with you, to have them confide in you and be able to build that relationship is significant in terms of getting the actual work done versus families that are more familiar with all these systems that they need to navigate.
Yeah, I think that's important. And once again, we're not comparing families. I'm just speaking to what.
Yeah, generalization.
Yeah, generalization. So one of the things that is important to understand in any level of social work is the historical trauma that some of these families might bring. I mean, just the migration, their lives or their places where they came from, their influences as they were growing up. So, I mean, we have an understanding of someone that was born in the United States and grew up in the United States, and we can kind of like can relate to that because it's here. But when we work with immigrant families and families that came from other places, it's very, very important to ask questions about how would you growing up, what access to services you had, what were the roles of different people in the family, because you have to understand all that. And so a lot of these families come with a lot of historical trauma that as a therapist, you have to also put into the context of why they might be doing the certain things. Because one of the things that you know as a child welfare social worker is that working with a child means working with a family. The child might be your client, but you're working with Tio Perto and Tio. I mean, because those are very influential people in their lives. So you always put it into the context of family. And I think that that also a big difference, you know, the concept of family versus a person that was born here or a person that was born in Mexico. And we're talking about family in Mexico. I mean, we're talking about how family gets influenced by things that happen in Mexico and other Latin American places, because there are things constantly happening over there that might influence the family over here.
Yeah. And I just wanted to also mention that right now we're talking just within the context of the work that we do here in this area. But I do have the opportunity through Social Work Mentor to kind of have some contact with social workers around the world, across the globe. And in that way, I'm able to kind of get some idea of what this kind of work looks like in places that I never would have thought, like in Nigeria and Malaysia and Australia, New Zealand. And the social work looks very different in different parts of the world. But for many of us, we work like in the San Francisco Bay Area where we are, it's a very international region. So we're talking about Latino families primarily, but correct, we do come into contact with other populations. And it is quite often the same dynamics where you're not just working with an individual, you're working, you know, with someone that had a very traumatic experience, maybe in Kenya, and now they're here on, you know, to work in the United States, but they've gone through some stuff and you need to connect with that stuff before you can even begin to address the presenting issues that you're faced with. So again, we're talking within the context of the majority of the work that we see here, but it's really something that many of you who are watching this, you might not work with primarily a Latino population, but you might work with, you know, Southeast Asians that have a very similar experience in terms of trauma and those types of things.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Totally agree.
So you've talked a little bit about this, you know, how to the importance of building relationships and understanding families and how to work with them. But a thing that we've talked about recently that I find quite interesting, and I know both of us have kind of over the years talked about and worked on in different ways, is when you work in a system, in a bureaucratic system, a government agency or a large organization, and there's certain procedures or protocols in place or expectations, and as you get into the work, sometimes you find that those rules, although they're there with the best intentions and like we talked about before, maybe legal issues or ethical issues, they sometimes get in the way of actually serving the family. So the quandary that we find ourselves in sometimes is how do you kind of, you know, when appropriate, how do you go right to that line? How do you figure out when, you know, you can kind of push the limits a little bit? And you talked about some good examples when you were in the correctional system, how maybe there were minor, quote unquote, minor things that you could let slide in the bigger picture of serving that individual or helping that individual. So I don't know if you, do you have any thoughts on, especially for maybe workers who are just starting in the field and trying to figure out, you know, how to work with families when they have all of these rules or expectations or guidelines that are sometimes constraining. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that it is important. It is a must that you must understand what the policy and guidelines are for your department, whatever you work at. By no means you are to not follow those guidelines and policies.
Exactly.
So that's really important to understand. Now, that said, you're the families here and you are here and in the middle there are policies and procedures. And the goal, remember, is always to develop a relationship. So in working with families, you are interpreting the policies and procedures and you're following the policy and procedures within the context of developing a relationship.
Right.
And I know that's hard and complicated what I just said, and it's not very clear. I think for an example, it's hard to give example because everything is different. Mm-hmm. I think that, generally speaking, you should always strive to develop that relationship. Mm-hmm. For example, I know in the Department of Family and Children Services, clients have to drug test, you know. And this might get controversy, but I'm the one for controversy. But so if a parent misses a test in the Department of Family and Children Services, the department and the, I don't know, I've been away from the department for 7 years, but I know it is called an administrative test, administrative miss, no?
I believe it still is. I haven't done that specifically in a while.
That's something that as a social worker, you have to understand what does that mean. Okay, Peter or Pedro didn't test today on Friday, and they were supposed to test. So does that mean that Peter is using does Peter has a pattern of not following their tests? Or that really means that Peter had a very complicated day where last night he couldn't sleep. He was anxiety about his family and all the things that he has to do. His phone wasn't charged enough, so he couldn't call. He had traffic, so he had so many things. He had to go to work, and then he had a meeting, and then he had to go test. Mm-hmm. But the testing was far. So there's a lot of factors that had to do with that test. So as a social worker, this is what I would suggest that you, the policy is that Peter has to test. We're not saying, no, he doesn't have to test. That's a mandate by the court. But I want you to understand it in the context of what is happening to Peter and be compassionate. Yeah. And if Peter is lying to you, then you'll figure it out later on.
Right.
Because there's going to be a pattern of missed tests. Mm-hmm. But the goal is to always see how your response to Peter is going to either develop more this relationship or it's going to damage their relationship. Mm-hmm. Peter, hey, you have a test, man. You miss a test. Tell me what happened. That could be a possible answer instead of, oh, Peter, you missed a test. This is considered an administrative test and you're not following the guidelines of the policies of the department.
Yeah. And I'm going to write it in your report and you're going to lose your child. And
exactly. You know. So I, my I would rather, and I have supervised interns, social work interns. You know, I supervise MSW interns in Department of Family and Children Services. Mm-hmm. I supervise interns in mental health. So once again, I'm not saying that the policies are not important, but how do you interpret those policies and how do you apply those policies in the context of relationship? And that doesn't mean that, you know, that you break those policies, but there has to be some flexibility and there has to be critical thinking. That's another big topic. But it has to be critical thinking. This is not a black and white. The rules are black and white. But your interpretation and your response to these families cannot be a black and white interpretation. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You could add more to it, Ernesto.
The thing that I wanted to add that you make me think about is that when we are working with families, oftentimes, I know in child welfare, but I think social work in general, we're trying to help individuals throughout these things they're going through in their lives and the systems that they're in. We're trying to address parts of those systems that will help them to get this done. And in doing so, it's easy to identify all those kind of negatives, those deficits that, Pedro missed the bus, Pedro, he doesn't have good time management and therefore mm-hmm. he's not able to drug test. And then can we trust him because he's not testing, because then he didn't drug test. And so he wasn't able to do X, and, you know, it just goes on. And we start finding, you know, he didn't go to his visit with his child or he didn't finish his class or whatever. And if you got into it, you would, as you mentioned, find out all these other pieces to it that are part of the puzzle. But as social workers, I think we need to also be more balanced sometimes in our approach and not only look at those deficits along that timeline. Let's say we're looking at a week of time. In that week of time, he missed his drug test. He got to his parenting class late. He only, was able to stay 15 minutes with his visit with his child. You know, whatever it is, all these things. But also, he got to work every single day of the week. He was able to pay his child support and he was able to get his rent paid. And he, made two other visits on time and spent quality time with his child. And, you know, there's in between those deficits on that 1 week timeline, there's lots of other things that he did do that are part of the puzzle that we need to consider as the whole picture. And I think sometimes if we're able to do that, it makes it much easier to look at this whole picture of Pedro and work with him to build that relationship and understand his reality, as opposed to just seeing those negatives and basing our assessment, basing our reports, basing all that stuff off of those deficits or negative that have occurred.
That's great. That's a great way to put it. That's really great. I always remember, and this is a story that is close to my heart, about a teenager that he was in runaway status. He ran away from the group home. But I knew he would regularly call me to check in with me. And I knew where he was staying. So although the department had it on runaway status, I knew where he was at. So my goal was not to force him back into a group home, but was to support him while he was away from the group home in runaway status. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm talking about. He was in runaway status and he ran away from the group home. He will check in with me. And so once again, we have one side is the rule. And the other side, we had reality. And in the middle, we have two people trying to work things out.
And if you were to just come straight and crack down on him just come 100% with the rule, with the regulation and say, you're in violation, you're not here, I'm going to write you up, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. What would be the end outcome of that likely versus working with them, understanding, you know, taking safety and risk into consideration, obviously, and doing the best you can to address those. But working with him, what would be the long-term outcome? Because, you know, and I think in social work, sometimes we have to think about, you know, sure, in the moment we're working with someone and we have immediate concerns or immediate needs that need to be addressed.
Yeah.
But social work is often also a long-term prospect, you know, a month, 6 months, 2 years, you know, we're working with families over the long term. So is it worth, sometimes you have to consider, is it worth it to crack down on someone now and lose them for the big outcome that you're trying to get to? Or is this something you can kind of, you know, wiggle around a little bit?
I mean, understanding and providing, you're not hiding the information. And I was never hiding the information that I knew where he was at. It was something creative in this, with this kid too, is that he needed money. So here I am. I have a government job and I had money. But I didn't take him to the ATM and gave him $200 because that would have been unethical, you know. Uh-huh. But, you know, he came up. He wanted to do a yard sale. Hmm. So I remember asking my colleagues, hey, do you have some old stuff in your garage that you want to get rid of it? And I remember I had a Volkswagen van at the time. I remember loading up my van with all these people left. Rough stuff to work, and like a lot of stuff, and I remember loading all my van and delivering all this stuff to this kid, and he had a yard sale, and it was things that were donated from all the social workers in the department. So once again, you know, I mean, some people might say that I was wrong in doing that.
Yeah, that's not in the – you're not going to find that in the guidebook anywhere.
No, you're not going to. But the goal was, how do I get him money? You know, if he would have come into the group home, he could have received money. I mean, he could have the benefit. But he didn't want to be in the group home.
And I think, you know, quite often, and maybe even some people watching this would think this way, you're going to find people who would be totally against that. Say, no, you can't do that. That's unethical. There's boundary issues, those types of things. But, you know, that's looking at the negative deficit. But if you think about, what did you develop in that effort in terms of A, your relationship with this kid, B, you know, his own self-worth, his own empowerment, you know, your role and your position is not always just to just have people comply with X, Y, and Z of their case plan. We're working with people. These people are not just a case plan. They're individuals that are, you know, our code of ethics demands that we serve them in such a way that they're empowered to lead healthy lives. And so sometimes that empowerment or that advocacy is just not written into the rule book. And because of that, people who are more closely, you know, connected with or guided by the protocols may see that differently and challenge you on that. But at the end of the day, what's the long-term outcome that you're trying to reach with these individuals that you...
Yeah, and once again, this is not about going against the protocols and the procedures that your department has, you know. But, you know, it is, how do you become creative in meeting their family's needs. I think that recently in this pandemic, one of the biggest challenges that my families, I call them my, and that's the social work language, my families, because that's something that we could touch about when people feel like you feel you could have emotional detachment from these families. And be honest with you, Ernesto, it is almost impossible for me. It's not that I am enmeshed with them, but they are my families. You know, I'm their social worker. They're therapists.
You're aligned recently, with them. You're side by side with them.
Yeah. Recently there was a kid that needed a computer, and the school district had not provided a computer. But he also needed a computer that he could, I could actually access him to telehealth, you know, and to relationships and other connections. I think actually I was able to get him a computer. County Office of Education had a program where they were donating computers for kids, but I didn't know that. And somebody sent an email to County Office of Education and connected this family with this computer. So, I mean, once again, the family doesn't have the resources. What do you do? Do you just say, oh, I'm sorry, my department doesn't provide computers? or you try to use that relational approach, because like with other people, so I was able to connect with someone that had a connection with County Office of Education, and they provided the computer. End result, I've been meeting weekly with this kid, doing telehealth, because he has a computer. So
at the end of the day, you know, you stayed within the bounds of all the rules and protocols and everything, but you were able to now provide long-term impact to this person, this youth, that maybe if you hadn't been creative within those protocols, it just would have, like you said, cut it and we can't move any further. The barrier's there and that's it.
Correct.
Relationship over.
Yes.
Well, it's so interesting, all of these things that we're talking about, and I, you know, I know as we're recording this, you know, we both have our families and things to address and get to today, on this weekend. But I did want to kind of close here, and I think, you know, as you mentioned throughout the interview, this discussion, there's a lot of other areas that we could talk about and go into. It's just so amazing how social work and related fields are so dynamic and things that we can discuss. But in general, with this whole pandemic and the challenges that we're all going through, do you have any thoughts on, you know, because again, going back to deficits and strengths, are there any positives or you know, opportunities or things that you've seen, that you've experienced going through this the past months now, that you think are maybe things that'll impact your practice long term, things that you've developed or learned or understood?
You know, I think that, I mean, I think social work is also, it's self-analysis. As a social worker, you should also be having reflective practice with your supervisor. And every social worker should have some kind of like supervision. So one of the things, this self-analysis, is that how do you manage your emotions and keep yourself together? So the pandemic, at least for me, has brought me, I have connected more emotionally to compassion. I think that compassion is part of social work. And I always been inspired by the work of Gregory Boyle from
Homeboy Industries.
Homeboy Industries Tattoos of the Heart, that book, and his compassion towards individuals.
And so, he's a great example of everything we're talking about today, too.
Correct. Yeah. Relational, compassionate. I mean, he's a Jewish priest. And it doesn't really, I mean, his language and how he developed the connection with that population, his dedication and compassionate. And look at the products that we have nowadays, you know. Yeah. I think, a long time ago, we went to L.A. and we had breakfast at Home Girl Cafe. That was before pandemic, and that was accelerating to me to see the work that he's done. And I think that one of the things that I have benefited from the pandemic is about connecting to my own self and how I connect more to what does it mean to be a social worker. And so there's two major things that I'm constantly reminding myself. It's about my relationship with these families, and being compassionate for what they have, for what they're going through. And I think that sometimes even with hard clients, you know, with difficult clients, we have to find that piece of compassion that, like, would you call it, instead of concentrating on the deficit, in finding something that is that connect us with them, you know. And I mean, on the side, I, besides my job, I also do provide services, mental health services, and basically men or, you know, domestic violence. And recently, in a case that I've been working with, you know, it's not about it, how do you teach reflection. So if you and I are having a conversation and you disagree with me, and what is the expectation that I have from you?
Right.
Do I want you to agree with me, or do I want you just to listen to me? So I just want you to listen, and I just want you to listen and be reflective. I just wanted to say, Enrique, I don't agree with you, but hey, you know, I'm open. Mm-hmm. I'm open to explore that, you know. So anyway, I think that that's how do we every day, how do we manage our emotions and how our emotions relate to our work? I think that's the most important thing in what we're going through right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's super significant, obviously, because, you know, we were talking before we started this conversation, before we pressed record, just at least for me, how COVID and this shutdown and everything has impacted just the, you know, the pressures that one might feel, or the anxiety, the stress levels. And so, you know, to really, you have to be in touch with those things. You have to understand them and try to process through them. You know, get into therapy or whatever it is to help you, again, process that. Because if you can't do that, I mean, most of us who are in this field know that you're not going to really be able to truly give your best self to the individuals and families you work with. So, and I agree, you know, COVID and the shutdown has really brought that out. Some of us, you know, if you're working from home, it's easy now to be isolated. Yeah, we have our Zoom meetings and we have, you know, our check-ins and those types of things, but it can be quite isolating to in this current style of work. And so that's why it's so significant.
Yeah. And this is the biggest suggestion, and this I strongly recommend all social workers to be open to their supervisors, to their managers, about what emotional struggles they're having. And once again, this is I'm going to put my union hat on, and and this is to protect yourself and to be honest. You know, the department might want you to do certain things, and you're doing what your job is, but at the same time, you have to be open. How are you managing? Mm-hmm. How are you managing your emotions? You're not a superhero. You know,
speak for yourself.
You're a human being with emotions, and you get impacted by your work. And important to really be honest and talk about those issues.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think on that note, recognizing that none of us are superheroes, the job might want us to be, but we can't be superheroes, but we try our best every single day, you know, in the work that we do. So I want to thank today's superhero, Enrique Alvarez, yeah, right. for this conversation today. It's super interesting, at least to me. And I hope it's been valuable to people who are watching this and listening. You know, there's a lot of things about social work that aren't covered always in the books and in the trainings, although that's great information too. But it's these real conversations, I think, that can sometimes shed some light and provide insight to workers on the nuts and bolts in the field, you know, on the ground of doing the work. So I want to thank you for sharing that experience. And, you know, we uncovered several other areas, and maybe hopefully we'll have some further conversations with Enrique and in the future. So anything you'd like to finish off with, Enrique?
No, just thank you, Ernesto, for doing this and providing this platform for this conversation. I think it's really important to support other social workers in the field, and especially share our experiences.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Okay. So everybody, we will hopefully see you next time. Stay in touch with us through social media at Social Work Mentor. And that way you'll be notified when our next one comes up and you're able to watch it. So until next time, get out there, do some social work, and take care of yourselves. We'll see
you later. Vote.
And vote if you get this and if you see this in time for the vote.
Yeah.
All right. See you later, everybody.
Thank you.
So I hope you enjoyed that interview with Mr. Enrique Alvarez. I thought he brought up a number of good points and interesting things to consider as we all go through our practice day to day and see how we could apply some of those concepts in our work. If you're interested in providing some feedback or questions about the episode, just look us up on Social Work Mentor on any of your social media platforms, or you can even email us at info@socialworkmentor.com. We're looking at the next person that we're going to have for our interview in this series coming up shortly. And actually, based on some of the topics we covered in this interview, we're looking at also scheduling another upcoming date with Mr. Alvarez to hear some more of his insights from his work in the field. So thanks again for listening. Subscribe to this podcast. Find us on social media and follow us there. And we look forward to having you here for the next interview. Have a good day, everybody.